You know, there's a reason for cautionary tales.
Then why don't more people heed their warnings?
I don't know. But after they hear my new show, they will think twice.
Oh yeah? About what?
Eating Tide Pods, playing with Ouija boards, talking to Karens, you name it. If you should heed caution, we're talking about it.
Check out Harper's brand new podcast, Cautionary Tales with Harper. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you download podcasts.
And be sure to press subscribe and give us a review.
Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Subscribe wherever you download podcasts today.
What appeared to be a loving marriage on the surface would soon come into question when the body of Kathleen Peterson was found at the bottom of her staircase at her home. Her husband Michael would soon become the main suspect, tried and convicted of the murder, unwilling to accept the verdict. A second trial was eventually granted. Who was the killer, though, and how did Michael end up the main suspect?
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Michael Ivor Peterson is an American novelist who was convicted in 2003 of murdering his second wife, Kathleen Peterson, on December 9th of 2001. After 8 years, Peterson was granted a new trial. The judge ruled a critical prosecution witness gave misleading testimony. In 2017, Peterson submitted an Alford plea to the reduced charge of manslaughter. He was sentenced to time already served and freed. Peterson's case is the subject of a documentary miniseries, The Staircase, which started filming soon after his arrest in 2001 and followed events until his eventual Alford plea in 2017. In 2019, he released his own account of his life since his wife's death in an independently published memoir, Behind the Staircase. So this is certainly a very interesting case. I've been diving into it on watching the documentary series, The Staircase, on Netflix right now. And it was actually turned out to be a two-part documentary series because of the 8 years in between everything where they didn't know what was going to be happening with him. But it's one of those that really, it's kind of slow moving, but just sucks you in. And so that's what I've been consuming over the last couple of days, and I'm still not quite done with it, but I can say my opinion has evolved and gone back and forth many which ways throughout watching this series about his life. What's your knowledge on the case? Carol Hughes joining us on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
You know, I remember watching it, and that's about it. I remember like something about a wife and falling down the stairs. But that's about it.
Sure.
But one thing that is worth noting, just in case somebody doesn't know about that Alford plea.
Yeah.
So you're pleading. It's like you a guilty plea, but not admitting guilt. It's kind of this weird, like, you're not admitting that you did it. You're still maintaining your innocence.
Yeah, it's a weird way of doing it. It's you're pleading guilty, but you're pleading guilty because there's no other way to like around it. Even though you don't agree that you're guilty, you are putting in a guilty plea. I don't know.
I think that kind of like you're putting in the plea, this Alford plea, because you think the evidence is going to show that you're guilty, but
or the evidence has been tainted and you can't use it.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it breaks my heart. Anybody who would, I heard of a guy the other day got out of prison after like 35 years, a crime he never committed. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I could see some, that would be a horrible situation. Like, what if he didn't do it?
Oh, it'd be,
if you really do it. And they're going to, they're doing everything they can to prove that you did. So that's an interesting kind of plea. And I think anytime you plead to anything, then it's like, see, obviously he did it.
Yeah.
Even though the plea that you took says you didn't, that I'm going to say you've got a lot of evidence, but I still didn't do it.
It's the reason why we have crazy disclaimers on things that you can't understand or read because of all these different ways of, well, this means that, or that doesn't mean this. And I mean, fuck, I mean, this is, you know, timely. Just think about voting. I remember, and this is where it gets tricky, is when you have ballot initiatives and things up. Unless you're like familiar with a ballot initiative and know what you should be voting for, those things are worded in such a screwed up way. In such, it's not even like legalese. It's almost like they're like bad word problems from like third grade, where it's like, well, I know what I want to say on this, but I don't know if yes really means no or no really means yes. I had a couple of those
several years back, several elections back, and I don't remember what it was.
Yeah.
But like, let's say it was to build the new arena.
Sure.
So they basically came out and said, if you want the new arena, you have to vote no.
Yeah.
Whatever it was opposite of what you would think. It's like, here's the arena. Yes, I want it. And I don't think it was the arena for anyone.
It was something, though.
But it was something like that, that there was this big campaign and billboards and everything. If you are for that, make sure you vote no.
Yeah.
Because it was totally backwards.
It's designed to confuse. I mean, Alfred Plea, you have an attorney doing it. Alfred Plea, also called the Kennedy Plea in West Virginia, in the United States, is a guilty plea in criminal court whereby a defendant in a criminal case does not admit to the criminal act and asserts innocence. In entering, so following along yet, in entering an Alfred plea, the defendant admits that the evidence presented by the prosecution would be likely to persuade a judge or jury to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Alfred pleas are legally permissible in nearly all U.S. federal state courts, but are not allowed in state courts in Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey. So it's one of those where there's this bizarre circumstances of, you know, yes, all the evidence points to this, but our evidence is fairly flawed or skewed. But if admitted, would influence someone in a way that it probably shouldn't. But there's no way of keeping that evidence out of the case. So that,
I think that sometimes people, if they're able to use that plea, that Alfred plea.
Yeah.
Like let's say, if you're found guilty of this, you're going to spend 40 years in the slammer, no chance for parole.
Sure.
If you do this Alfred plea, 20 years, no chance of parole. So I think there's sometimes that factors in, and it's like, man, this is going to be hard to get out of, and this will reduce my sentence, and I'll go with that.
Yeah.
Then, of course, go with that, and everybody says, see, he did it.
Yeah. And in the end, you just more than anything want your name just to be cleared and to show, look, no, I'm not this monster that you want to think I am. But it's the criminal justice system in the United States. Not exactly, wonderful, as you know. And there's plenty others in many other countries that are far worse. Yes. But it is very broken in the United States as well. There's no doubt about that. Let's continue on to the story here and learn about the chapters of what Michael Peterson had to endure and went through our judicial system. Michael Ivor Peterson was born near Nashville, Tennessee, to the son of Eugene Ivor Peterson and Eleanor Peterson. He graduated from Duke University with a bachelor's degree in political science. While there, Peterson was president of Sigma Nu Fraternity and was editor at The Chronicle, the daily student newspaper, from 1964 to 65. He attended classes at the law school of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. After graduating, Peterson took a civilian job with the U.S. Department of Defense, where he was assigned to research arguments supporting increased military involvement in Vietnam. That year, he also married Patricia Sue, who taught at an elementary school at Rhein-Main Air Base in West Germany. They had two children, Clayton and Todd. In 1968, Peterson enlisted in the United States Marine Corps and served in the Vietnam War. In 1971, he received an honorable discharge with the rank of captain after a car accident left him with a permanent disability. Years later, during a mayoral campaign, Peterson claimed he had won a Silver Star, a Bronze Star with Valor, and two Purple Hearts. He had all the medals, but said he did not have the documentation for them. Peterson claimed he had received one Purple Heart after being hit by shrapnel when another soldier stepped on a landmine, and the other when he was shot. He later admitted his war injury was not the result of the shrapnel wound in Vietnam, but was the result of a car accident in Japan, where he was stationed after the war as a military policeman. The Raleigh, North Carolina News and Observer said records did not contain any mention of the two Purple Hearts that Peterson said he had received. However, military files verified that he received the Silver Star and the Bronze Star Medal with Valor. Peterson and his first wife, Patricia, lived in Germany for some time. There, they befriended Elizabeth and George Ratcliffe and their two children, Margaret and Martha. After George's death, the Peterson and Ratcliffe families became very close. When Elizabeth Ratcliffe died in 1985, Michael became the guardian of her two children. After Michael and Patricia divorced in 1987, Clayton and Todd lived with Patricia and Margaret, and Martha stayed with Michael, who then moved to Durham, North Carolina. Clayton and Todd later also joined their father. Peterson wrote three novels based around his experiences during the Vietnam conflict. The Immortal Dragon, A Time of War, and A Bitter Peace. He co-wrote the biography Charlie Two Shoes and the Marines of Love Company with journalist David Perlmutt, and co-wrote Operation Broken Reed with Lieutenant Colonel Arthur L. Boyd. Peterson also worked as a newspaper columnist for the Durham Sun-Herald, where his columns became known for their criticism of police and of Durham County District Attorney James Hardin Jr. Hardin was the prosecutor of Peterson for the murder of his second wife, Kathleen. In 1989, Michael moved in with Kathleen Atwater, a successful Nortel business executive. They married in 1997, and Kathleen's daughter, Caitlin, joined the extended family that now consisted of Clayton, Todd, Martha, and Margaret. On December 9th of 2001, Peterson called an emergency line to report that he had just found Kathleen's unconscious body in their Forest Hills mansion and suspected she had fallen down 15, 20, I don't know, stairs. He later claimed that he had been outside by the pool and had come in at 2:40 a.m. to find Kathleen at the foot of the stairs. Peterson said she must have fallen down the stairs after consuming alcohol and Valium. Toxicology results show that Kathleen's blood alcohol content was 0.07. The autopsy report concluded that the 48-year-old woman sustained a matrix of severe injuries, including a fracture of the thyroid, neck, cartilage, and 7 lacerations to the top and back of her head, consistent with blows from a blunt object, and had died from blood loss 90 minutes to 2 hours after sustaining the injuries. Kathleen's daughter, Caitlin, and Caitlin's sister, Candace Zampinari, both initially proclaimed Michael's innocence and publicly supported him alongside his children, but Zampinari reconsidered after learning of Peterson's bisexuality, as did Caitlin after reading her mother's autopsy report. Both subsequently broke off from the rest of the family. Although forensic expert Henry Lee, hired by Peterson's defense, testified that the blood splatter evidence was consistent with an accidental fall down the stairs, police investigators concluded that the injuries were inconsistent with such an accident. As Peterson was the only person at the residence at the time of Kathleen's death, he was the prime suspect and was soon charged with her murder. He pled not guilty. The medical examiner, Deborah Radish, concluded that Kathleen had died from laceration to the scalp caused by a homicidal assault. According to Radish, the total of 7 lacerations to the top and back of Kathleen's head were the results of repeated blows with a light yet rigid weapon. The defense disputed their story. Although to their analysis, Kathleen's skull had not been fractured by the blows, nor was she brain damaged. It was inconsistent with injuries sustained in a beating death. The trial drew increasing media attention, and details of Peterson's private life emerged. Hardin and his prosecution team, among them Mike Nifong attacked Peterson's credibility, focusing on his alleged misreporting of his military service and what they described as a gay life, quote-unquote, he had led and kept secret. The prosecution contended that the Petersons' marriage was far from happy, suggesting that Kathleen had discovered Michael's alleged secret gay life and wanted to end their marriage. It was the main motive that the prosecution offered at trial for Kathleen's alleged murder, the other being a $1.5 million life insurance policy. According to Assistant District Attorney Fredra Black, Kathleen would have been infuriated by learning that her husband, who she truly loved, was bisexual and having an extramarital relationship, not with another woman, but a man, which would have been humiliating and embarrassing for her. We believe that once she learned this information, that the argument ensued and the homicide occurred. The defense argued that Kathleen accepted Michael's bisexuality and that their marriage was very happy, a position supported by Michael and Kathleen's children and other friends and associates. The prosecution said that Kathleen's murder was most likely committed with a custom-made fireplace poker called a blow poke. It had been a gift to the Petersons from Kathleen's sister, but was missing from the house at the time of the investigation. Late in the trial, the defense team produced the missing blow poke, which they said had been overlooked in the garage by police investigators. Forensic tests revealed that it had been untouched and unmoved for too long to have been used in the murder. A juror contacted after the trial noted that the jury dismissed the idea of the blow poke as the murder weapon. Suspicions surrounding Elizabeth Ratcliffe's death. Elizabeth Ratcliffe, the friend of the Petersons who died in Germany in 1985, had also been found dead at the foot of her staircase with injuries to the head. Her death had been investigated by both the German police and U.S. military police. An autopsy at the time of her death concluded Ratcliffe died from an intracerebral hemorrhage secondary to the blood coagulation disorder, von Willebrand's disease, based on blood in her cerebral fluid, and reports that she had been suffering severe persistent headaches in the weeks leading up to her death. The coroner determined that the hemorrhage resulted in immediate death, followed by Ratcliffe falling down the stairs after collapsing. The Petersons had dinner with Ratcliffe and her daughters, and Peterson had stayed and helped Ratcliffe put the children to bed before going home. The children's nanny, Barbara, discovered the body when she arrived the next morning. Peterson was the last known person to see her alive. Before Peterson's trial, the Durham court ordered the exhumation of Ratliff's embalmed body, buried in Texas, for a second autopsy in April of 2003. Arrangements were made for the Durham medical examiner, who had initially performed Kathleen's autopsy, to perform this reevaluation over the objections of defense counsel, who argued that the autopsy should be performed by Texas medical examiners. The body was then transported from Texas to Durham. The Durham ME found sufficient evidence drawn from the results of the second autopsy, along with new witness statements describing the scene, to overturn their earlier findings and list Ratcliffe's cause of death as homicide. The prosecution declined to accuse Peterson of Ratcliffe's death, but introduced the death into the trial as an incident giving Peterson the idea of how to fake Kathleen's accident. Despite police reports that there was very little blood at the scene of Ratcliffe's death, the nanny, who was the first to discover Ratliff's body in 1985, took the stand at Peterson's trial and testified that there was a large amount of blood at the scene. Another witness testified to spending much of the day cleaning blood and stains off the wall. The admissibility to the Ratliff evidence in court was one of the grounds for the subsequent appeal against his conviction lodged by Peterson's lawyer in 2005. In October of 2002, acting as administrator of Kathleen's estate, Caitlin filed a wrongful death claim against Peterson. In June 2006, he voluntarily filed for bankruptcy. 2 weeks later, Caitlin filed an objection to the bankruptcy. On February 1st, 2007, Caitlin and Peterson settled the wrongful death claim for $25 million, pending acceptance by the courts involved. Finalization of the settlement by the court was announced on February 1st of 2008. In the settlement, Peterson did not admit that he murdered Kathleen. And on October 10th of 2003, after one of the longest trials in North Carolina history, a Durham County judge found Peterson guilty of the murder of Kathleen. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Denial of parole requires premeditation. Despite the jury accepting the murder was a spur-of-the-moment crime, they also found it was premeditated. As one juror explained it, premeditated meant not only planning hours or days ahead, but could also mean planning the seconds before committing a spur-of-the-moment crime. Peterson was housed at the Nash Correctional Institution near Rocky Mount until he was released on December 16th of 2011. So that's where we are thus far in the case before the appeal. Found guilty, and then he ends up being in jail for, or prison for about 8 years until the appeal process finally gained some traction and they were able to point out many issues with that first trial that went on.
For example, could you explain to me that what that was again, the premeditated.
Yeah.
But if you thought about it a second before the moment, but it was a second before, so therefore it's premeditated?
That doesn't make any sense at all, because premeditated really does mean you are planning this in advance.
Every crime would be premeditated.
Everything, yeah. Because
crime of passion would be premeditated.
Yep. Seconds before would be premeditated. And that's not something I believe a jury is, you know, that redefines a word. And you can't redefine a word when you're...
And that was a jurist that said that.
Yes. So, it's...
I mean, that makes no sense.
No, not at all.
Because every crime then would be... premeditated.
If you were walking down the road one day and decided to hold up the 7-Eleven, but you had no plans on doing it, but you just did it, and that would not, that would be, if you thought about it as you were walking up to the building, that would be then considered premeditated.
I mean, and there's so many, you know, arguments that break out between people.
Yeah.
That they're drunk and there was a gun and they shot him. It's like, or maybe they went to the bedroom and got the gun.
Sure.
So then they had to walk all the way there, therefore it'd be premeditated. But the fact was they got in an argument and they're drunk and they should have just slept it off.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like you went into the night going, I'm going to kill that person. That's weird. Okay.
There's a lot of things that went on in this trial that I'm assuming we're going to get to here in a few moments that were very off in that first case in terms of evidence and what they had actually found and what they were trying to duplicate for their own use, for the not for the defense of Michael Peterson, but for the state, for the prosecution, that it was just almost ridiculous watching them try to come up with some of these things to show the jury to convince them one way or the other. And honestly, at the end of the day with this thing, I don't think I'm going to profess to know the answer of innocence or guilt, but I can profess to say, at least, there was a lot of incompetence on the part of the state's prosecution of this man that totally fucked the whole thing up, that had they done it correctly, they probably wouldn't have been an appeal. There wouldn't have been all these questions and there, you know. And it's a shame because this man will always, for his rest of his life, have this cloud above his head, and his family has this cloud above their head without being able to get to a definitive answer because of the state not doing their job correctly. So it's hard to know, in my opinion, innocence or guilt. There's so many things that really, for the I would say a lot of things I lean more towards probably innocent. But he's an interesting character, in my opinion, when I watched the documentary. And to me, I don't know how I feel at the end. But let's continue on with this and see if my opinion still changes or your opinion develops or changes as we continue into the Michael Peterson story. Peterson's appeal was filed by his defense counsel, Thomas Mayer, now serving as his court-appointed attorney. And was argued before the North Carolina Court of Appeals on April 18th of 2006. On September 19th, the Court of Appeals rejected Peterson's argument that he did not get a fair trial because he repeated judicial mistakes. The appeals ruling said the evidence was fairly admitted. The judges did find defects in a search warrant, but said it had no ill effect on the defense. Because the ruling was not unanimous under North Carolina law, Peterson had a right to appeal to the North Carolina Supreme Court, which accepted the case. Oral arguments were heard on September 10th of 2007. On November 9th, the court announced that it affirmed the decision of the appeals, absent the reconsideration of the ruling or the raising of a federal issue. Peterson had exhausted his appeal of the verdict. On November 12th of 2008, attorneys Jay Burkhart Bale and Jason Anthony of Richmond, Virginia, who are now representing Peterson, filed a motion for a new trial in Durham County Court on three grounds: that the prosecution withheld evidence about the blowpoke, that the prosecution used an expert witness whose qualifications were disputed, and that one juror based his judgment on racial factors. On March 10, 2009, Peterson's notion was denied by the Durham County Superior Court. In late 2009, a new theory of Kathleen's death was raised, that she had been attacked by an owl outside, fallen after rushing inside, and been knocked unconscious after hitting her head on the first tread of stairs. The owl theory was raised by Durham attorney T. Lawrence Pollard, a neighbor of the Petersons who was not involved in the case, but had been following the public details. He approached the police, suggesting an owl might have been responsible after reading the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation's evidence list and finding a feather listed. Peterson's attorney had determined that the SBI crime lab report listed a microscopic owl feather and a wooden silver from a tree limb entangled in a clump of hair that had been pulled out of the roots found clutched in Kathleen's left hand. A re-examination of the hair in September of 2008 found two more microscopic owl feathers. According to Pollard, had a jury been presented with this evidence, it would have materially affected their deliberation and therefore would have materially affected their ultimate verdict. Prosecutors have ridiculed the claim that Ann Deborah Radish, who conducted Kathleen's autopsy, says that it was unlikely that an owl or any other bird could have made wounds as deep as those on her scalp. However, Radish's opinion was challenged by other experts in three separate affidavits filed in 2010. Despite interest in this theory among some outside advocates, no motion for a new trial was filed on this point in 2009. On March 2, 2017, following his Elford plea, Peterson's attorney filed a motion to allow him to pay for a bird expert at the Smithsonian Institution to examine feather fragments found in Kathleen's hair to determine if she was attacked by a raptor. In August of 2010, following a series of newspaper articles critical of the SBI, North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper led an investigation which resulted in the suspension of SBI analyst Dwayne Deaver, one of the principal witnesses against Peterson, after the report found his work among the worst done on scores of flawed criminal cases. Pollard subsequently filed affidavits to support a motion that Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson ordered the state medical examiner's office to turn over all documentation related to Kathleen's autopsy to Peterson's attorney. However, Judge Hudson barred Pollard from filing further motions on behalf of Peterson because he did not represent him. A new motion was filed in August of 2010 by David Rudolph, one of Peterson's original attorneys, who acted pro bono in proceedings challenging the SBI testimony. Deaver was fired from the SBI in January of 2011 after an independent audit of the agency found he had falsely represented evidence in 34 cases, including withholding negative results in the case of Greg Taylor, a North Carolina man who spent 17 years in prison on a murder conviction based on Deaver's testimony. A bloodstain analysis team that Deaver had trained was suspended and disbanded. In 2003, in the Peterson trial, Deaver testified that he had been mentored by SBI bloodstain specialist David Spittle and had worked 500 bloodstain cases, written 200 reports, and testified in 60 cases. During the retrial hearing, SBI Assistant Director Eric Hooks testified that Deaver had written only 47 reports. Spittle testified that he could not recall mentoring Deaver, who, since completing a two-day training course in the 1980s, had testified in only four cases, the Peterson case being the third. The SBI cited the bloodstain analysis given in the fourth case as the reason for firing Deaver. On December 16, 2011, Peterson was released from the Durham County Jail on $300,000 bail and placed under house arrest with a tracking anklet. His release on bond followed a judicial order for a new trial after Judge Hudson found that Deaver had given materially misleading and deliberately fake testimony about bloodstain evidence and his exaggerations, his training, experience, and expertise. Former North Carolina Attorney General Rufus Edmonstein said that any evidence gathered after Deaver arrived at the scene might be deemed inadmissible in a new trial. In July of 2014, Peterson's bond restrictions were eased. In October of 2014, the court appointed Mike Kinkusum to represent Peterson, replacing David Rudolph, who had been working pro bono on the case since Peterson's conviction was overturned. Rudolph had stated that he could no longer afford to represent Peterson without being paid. On November 14, 2016, Peterson's request for the second trial to be dismissed was refused, and a new trial was scheduled to begin May 8, 2017. However, a news report on February 7, 2017 indicated that a resolution had been negotiated by Rudolph once again representing Peterson and the Durham County District Attorney. On February 14, 2017, Peterson entered an Elford plea, a guilty plea entered because sufficient evidence exists to convict him of the offense, but the defendant asserts innocence of the voluntary manslaughter of Kathleen. The judge sentenced him to a maximum of 86 months in prison with credit for the time previously served. Because Peterson had already served more time than the sentence, 98.5 months, he did not face additional prison time. So, an owl. Thoughts on the owl?
You know, I had totally forgotten about that because I did watch that a really long time ago and I forgot about that owl part. But that's just crazy.
It's interesting, but there's evidence to support the possibility that there was an owl. I mean, how the hell else do you get owl feathers in your hair?
But like it was an owl feather in her hand and microscopic feathers in her on her scalp or something. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what a microscopic feather like.
Yeah.
That's pretty. And it seems like if there's microscopic feathers, it seems like if you were attacked by an owl, there would be some pretty, and it killed you, there would be some pretty good evidence in your scalp.
I don't know. I'm not an owl attacking expert, but I don't know how you would.
There are probably very few of those.
I don't know how you would get owl feathers, period, microscopic or not, in you or in your hands, had an owl not been in your immediate presence prior to your death.
And maybe the owl did kind of attack her. She gets disoriented, goes in the house. Because of an owl, like I had a squirrel jump on my head once, twice actually.
Lightning does strike twice.
Right. Once was at the laundromat when I was reading a magazine on the step. That's just another story in itself.
Yeah.
That it jumped on my head. And then once when I was like third grade, one jumped out of a tree.
Oh my God.
And it scared the crap out of me both times.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if an owl would have attacked you, and you're right by your house anyway.
Sure.
Like, it's just like some weird scene from The Birds. Otherwise, you're just out there in the same position. Like, you can't move, and the owl won't go away, and you're in distress. And then she goes running in her house and dies. That's weird.
Well, it's such a strange case. You know, the whole thing is just doesn't make sense. I mean, it really just doesn't make sense. Because, I mean, if he did kill her.
He could have. I don't know.
And that's, I mean, that the thing is, you would beat her with a blow poke down the stairs. I mean, and then
a blow poke, that's not, which is, I think, That just makes me laugh.
Well, yeah, and then expect not to be caught.
It sounds like some weird sex toy.
No.
But well, anyway, poke is outside in the garage and hasn't been used. Like, it would have evidence all over it.
None of it makes sense. I mean, if you're, it's just like, these are not stupid people. So I don't really see, you know, why that would be the way you're going to kill your wife if you're trying to do it, you know, inconspicuously or something. It just, none of it makes sense. His character is weird too. I mean, the lying about the purple hearts and shit, that's shady.
That doesn't make you guilty of murder.
It doesn't make you guilty of murder, but it certainly makes
does say something about your personality.
It does. It says something about your character, but it doesn't make you a murderer. And there, some people are just kind of, you know, they have that odd personality. And when I saw the doc, it felt a little off to me. It didn't feel like he was necessarily a murderer, but I can see where the offness was off-putting to that original jury. But again, there was just so many things that were flawed. And here's what pisses me off about a lot of this. And it's not Peterson at all, because, I mean, the way the judicial system fucked him, guilty or not, and obviously eventually found him, is it not guilty with the offer, whatever that verdict is, where he's free. But they did fuck him, especially with that expert witness that was testifying on the blood spattering. And because you heard about, he went to jail on basically that guy's testimony. That other guy got out after 17 years. I was watching him and him talking about that. How come there's no repercussions for somebody like that other than just being fired? You know, if someone is going around giving testimony that gets people locked away for years and changes lives, how is that person not found guilty or responsible? How is that just oh, you got fired, you can't do this job anymore? I would think that would be prosecutable right there.
I would think so. And it's so unethical.
Or they like covered by some
profession is, if you're a doctor, if you're an expert or whatever, that's so unethical.
Completely.
You hear about that all the time. Yeah.
Are you then covered by something that allows you to not be prosecuted because of your role in the case, no matter what, even if you are making a bunch of shit up? I don't know.
Not only making a bunch of shit up, they're making money. Like, they pay those people.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, that to me just seems like, at the very least, you would have civil liability against you, if not criminal liability. That to me is just, it's so scary that exists out there, and that they can find that, you know, the states will find witnesses and people like that to fit their the storyline that they want to go with. And it's up to you to prove them wrong. I mean, I know we always say innocent till proven guilty in this country, but, you know, that's, in reality, that's not how it works. It's more so guilty until proven innocent when charges are brought against you, because the public in mass, in most parts, will assume guilt. And then it's up to you to prove wrong while the government sits there and does everything they can to make the evidence fit their storyline, which it shouldn't. That's not how it should go. The evidence should just speak for itself, and then that's what presents the storyline. You don't like back build your evidence based on what you want it to look like if you're the state and you're being tried on something. That just doesn't make any sense. But that's unfortunately how, you know, all our systems seem to work. So that's my thoughts on the Peterson trial. We didn't get your thoughts, Carol. Do you think at the end of this, guilty or innocent, or he just kind of just, I don't know.
For me, it's a really, really big, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it would make some sense if he got some money from life insurance.
Sure.
If there was some kind of motive there. But there's no evidence that actually ties him to it.
No.
More evidence that an owl did it.
There is. And they didn't.
There should be some kind of DNA evidence
And that
one would think, or some DNA evidence on his clothing, or they find footprints, or there's something. Because if there was a lot of blood, you know, and if you were responsible for killing someone, that blood would have to get on you.
Sure. And the thing is, there was a bunch of mistreatment of the evidence between the first trial and the second, what was almost going to be a second trial, where they moved a lot of the evidence. Evidence bags had been tampered with or broken by moving crews when they had moved stuff around. And they never actually did the correct type of DNA test on her clothing, Kathleen's clothing, to determine, well, are we just going to find Michael and Kathleen's DNA on these clothing, or are we going to find another party's DNA on this as well? But they never went down that road to reveal that during the first case. Had they done that and revealed there's other DNA on her other than Michael and just her herself, that would have been opening them up then to the possibility of another murderer. But I guess I would be curious to see, you know, if an owl attacked your head, would there be owl DNA on you? That's kind of what I'm wondering.
It seems like their claws.
Yeah.
Is that what they're called? Like, whatever. Anyway, it seems like when they dig into you, if it would cause that kind of laceration on your head.
Talons.
The only way I think they would, that's it. I think the only way they could kill you is really to make you fall, like,
or bleed to death,
or orient you where you run into something, or you run out into traffic, or something like that. Because she was inside her house,
yeah,
there was no owl in the house,
and there was no the brain, the head. There was no brain damage. There was no skull fractures. It was torn skin.
So it seems like in that there would be dirt,
yeah,
or something. I don't know.
It truly
like not super clean.
Yeah.
You freeze all day.
And I don't know, I guess maybe, but again, like how many owl attack experts are there to go and say, oh yeah, that's an owl attack injury right there. You know, I don't know who or what that would be to definitively say something like that, but fucking birds are mean. That, you know, there are owls out there that I wouldn't be surprised if they attack people. I'm always like watching the hawks around here. I'm always concerned they're going to go pick up like one of my pigs in the backyard, because
this is why my cat doesn't get to go outside. And
yeah. I mean, birds are mean and they do attack people too. That is not unheard of for like a hawk or something to attack a person. Granted, we're talking about owl here, but you know, they can do those sort of things if they feel threatened. So, you know, as far out as the theory as that is, it's not so far out to me with the fact that they found microscopic owl feathers on this crime scene. Had that not been there, I would have been probably a little more dismissive on the owl theory. But I don't know. I think there may very well be, it's just one of those totally bizarre, you know, this is good luck ever having this exact scenario play out again, type things where an individual gets blamed and turns out she was attacked by an owl, completely just discombobulated, walking into the house and disoriented.
That seems like such a huge stretch.
It does, but you know, huge stretches do happen every now and then.
In a tree that like flew off and kind of swooshed down and kind of got close to her head and left a couple microscopic feathers.
She went
into the house and she tripped and fell down the stairs
while having alcohol. And I forgot what the other drug was. There was a prescribed Valium. So if I was drunk and on Valium and got attacked by an owl, I don't know that I would be able to walk down the stairs very easily either, quite honestly, if I'm that disoriented and just having been attacked by an owl.
That is totally like right out of an Alfred Hitchcock movie.
It is.
Like in the birds, like you get so, it was a Tippi Hedren and she's like, oh my God, and they're just attacking her. That's the vision I'm having.
The birds. Yeah.
And an owl would be pretty freaky if an owl attacked you, because they're big.
Yeah. They're big.
And their head's turn really weird, like.
They're smart and they know how to attack shit. And, you know, I mean, it, I don't know. I don't put it out of the possibilities of being what, you know, was the actual story. I, in his quest to get the Smithsonian owl expert in there. Okay. Get him in.
I'm bullshit on the owl thing.
Are you? I don't know. I'm not calling bullshit on the owl thing. I think that could be a possibility. I'm not saying I am 100% on the owl thing. I'm not saying 100% on any of this in this case, because I just don't know. But he was, you know, he did his, the time, and the judicial system did what it did. And there was many a fuck ups along the way. But I think it's one of those cases where there's no way to prove. And that's the way our system works. If it's not truly provable, the person, you know, you can't find them guilty. If you can't prove it, you can't base it on shit that somebody's making up. And that's how it works. Yeah,
the system also is set up to somebody who has money to pay a very good, competent lawyer.
Yes, it is.
The system can't. There's two different judicial systems.
You're 100% right. They even brought that up in the doc, in the Staircase documentary. He even brought that up. He's like, how the hell does someone who has no money fight this? And they're like, they don't.
They end up in prison.
No.
For years.
Yeah. He's like, they don't. And that's how the system is totally fucked up. Because Peterson had some money, but he ended up exhausting it all on all this. But he ended up spending, I believe, from what I remember in the doc, it was like around $750,000 to defend himself. And if he is innocent, that's not fair to him. That's not fair to anybody. Like, you have to spend every cent you've ever earned in your entire life and are going to earn to prove that you didn't do something. If you have the money, it drains you. If you don't have the money, you're fucked, and it also drains you. So it's just, I mean, it's a money-making industry, without a doubt, when you really look into it. Same with anything when you get into the legal system. Interesting doc out there about the divorce industry, Divorce Inc. Dr. Drew did that one. I found that really fascinating, of just how much that system is set up, not in the interest of either parties or a family, but in the interest of the attorneys back and forth on both sides, just fucking racking up bills, and how crooked that can get. No, it's scary. I mean, that's why it's, you know, I avoid the legal system like the fucking plague. And I don't do anything bad, but I don't like, I avoid putting myself in any situation where anyone could find some sort of reason to, you know, sue me for something, you know. It's like anything at all. It's like, I just fucking avoid it. You know, it's like, I don't want it, because it can get very expensive and crazy very fast. And, you know, just the fighting can ruin a life. Yeah, not even the charge, the fighting.
That is the truth.
So, interesting times, interesting story. I do recommend the doc. It's not an endorsement, but it is out there on Netflix. As of right now, we're recording this in October of 2019. This is actually, I believe, airing
2020.
In 2021. You're right, in 2020.
The luckiest year of all. October. That's why you defaulted to 2019.
Yes, I was looking at the date. It is the 19th of October is what I saw. So of 2020, October 19th of 2020 is when we're recording this. This episode actually is the very first episode of 2021. So happy fucking New Year, everybody. It's probably not going to be better.
I've been waiting for this.
It's probably not going to be better.
Happy 2020's over. But in real life, I've got 2.5 more long months.
Yeah, it is. We're now in 2021. It's the sequel. And we all know most sequels are shittier than the first. So that's how I'm going into 2021 with that pessimistic attitude.
I would ask you to tell me how the election went, but I don't want to know.
Don't have the answers to that yet either. But back to the future. Hopefully, I mean, I'm trying to have a positive attitude, but hopefully 2021 is a better year, but sequels usually suck. So Thinking on that note, we will wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts and leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts. We greatly appreciate it. Until next time, for Carol and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.